Hello and welcome back to the podcast of ideas. Joining me today is Academy of Ideas Director Claire Fox, Jeff Kidder, Jacob Reynolds, Rob Lyons, and I'm Ella Whelan. We've joined back together after an office meeting to talk about some of the big issues in the news this week. There's quite a lot to choose from. But Claire, let's start with the current fury over PMQs yesterday. We're talking on Thursday. Has often been a bit of a performance, the sort of sparring between Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer probably causes most people cringe than it does offence. But there was a particular exchange yesterday where Rishi Sunak has kind of made a jibe at Keir Starmer in a list of his U-turns, including his change of mind around the issue of gender ideology, women's rights. And Rishi Sunak said something like, you turned on your position on what is a woman, and then made a kind of bit of a snigger and said, well, that was only a 99% U-turn based on Keir Starmer's previous comments that 99% of women don't have a penis or something like that. And the reason why this caused controversy and has caused a lot of upset online is because the mother of the murdered teen, Brianna Jai, murdered trans teen, Esther Jai, was in the chamber, or at least had been at some point. It then transpired she wasn't at the point of Rishi Sunak's comments. Keir Starmer said to Rishi Sunak, for shame, of all weeks to make this comment, you do it when Brianna's mother's in the audience. Anyway, it has caused huge amount of discussion, and in particular sort of calls for censorship around certain issues being discussed. So Claire, what have you made of all of this?
So the first thing is that I actually find it irritating that we have a situation where the Prime Minister simply deals with the question, a very serious question, about the impact of gender ideology on society as a sort of sectarian soundbite to have a go at the leader of the opposition. It's not even original, do you know what I mean? It's just so lame. So that's the first thing. It's particularly irritating because actually this week there's been some very good work, very important evidenced work, done by the government, actually, by Government Minister Kemi Badenoch, in relation to the high prevalence of the number of young people who are transitioning, who are actually lesbian or gay, i.e. that they are, in their gender confusion, non-conforming gender dilemmas that they're having, are basically put on a treadmill or on a conveyor belt, is the appropriate term, for transitioning and changing gender. So that's like serious. That's what politics should be. And daft old Rishi Sunak comes in and makes this rather naff joke. I do actually think that originally Keir Starmer was shocked because he was so sensitive about the fact that Esther Jai was in the auditorium. But then it's been turned into this completely confected outrage that I think is really bad for politics. There's a number of reasons why, and I'd be interested to hear what other people think. I mean, first of all, you should not have to suspend political discourse and political argument because the mother of a child is in the audience or in the vicinity. I might think that, as Ella, you've just indicated, actually, she wasn't there. But I mean, if she was there, you might think it was a bit naff or a bit insensitive. But it shouldn't be that you should be sort of emotionally blackmailed into having a different political position. And I say this because it really, really, really came home to me that when we were discussing the online safety bill, I was warned on a number of occasions by a number of different peers in the House of Lords that I should be very careful of what I said, because the father of Molly Russell was in the visitors gallery, and that because the father of Molly Russell was there and he was demanding that there should be restrictions and bans and censorship of certain sites, that I was being insensitive by arguing for more free speech, that free speech should be respected. I couldn't believe that that was kind of like bullying me to be quiet. And you can see that these emotional cases can become rather damagingly used to curtail political discussion. But I do want to say that Esther Jai has been kind of stupendously generous in terms of the way she's dealt with the parents of the two young people who murdered her child. And in that sense, I think the nation's sympathies are, don't be annoying about her. But when you then see that Brianna's father has got involved and is demanding that the Prime Minister issues an apology and won't accept anything but a full and fulsome apology, you do think, oh no, this is going to ruin the whole thing. This is a personal, terrible tragedy. We don't know why this child was killed, but it's tragic no matter what. And turning it into a political football for all sorts of opportunistic reasons, or making it about, you know, whether you're the government are sensitive or not on the issue, is going to be censorious and irritating and is dangerous.
It is going to probably escalate. Rishi Sunak has now, the government has now agreed to some kind of meeting, and Rishi Sunak has already this week got himself into several bits of trouble for making personal deals with people over political issues. I'm talking about the bet he's made with Piers Morgan, stuff like that. So it's obviously completely incapable of handling any serious issue sensitively. But there is now, as is sort of expected, a discussion on Twitter with some politicians involved, suggesting that talking about the idea or saying a woman is a woman is offensive and causes people to commit suicide. This old argument of, you know, your language causes trans suicides has come back in full force, even though obviously we know that Brianna Jai's case was not a suicide. So it reinvigorates that sort of very toxic, censorious argument around discussion of trans issues. But sticking with the issue of censorship and trans issues, Jeff, I thought maybe you could tell us something about Lindsay Smith, who was expelled from Newcastle United for having a particular position in relation to gender ideology and women's rights, has been, you know, covered on some news channels and had a bit of press around it, but not many people actually know what's happened. So tell us about her.
Yes, this is a case that should be raised in Prime Minister's questions and should be widely viewed. So hopefully this will become a big campaign and spread far and wide. And it was initiated by a very good video produced by the Free Speech Union last week. And it's a terrible case where Lindsay Smith, who's a season ticket holder, or was a season ticket holder at Newcastle United, and happens to have gender critical views. Somebody had seen her views on Facebook, I believe, complained to Newcastle United, who then, in cohorts with a secretive unit at the Premier League in London, produced a dossier on her, exposing all kinds of things that she did, including walking her dog, including her Facebook posts. And as a result of this, she's been banned from St James's Park in Newcastle for two years. And we should note that she has done nothing wrong. She hasn't even, as far as I know, she hasn't even espoused her views in St James's Park, let alone done anything which would affect anybody else who goes to watch a match. It's not like in the past where you have somebody who people think is a hooligan, and whatever you think of the way that's dealt with, they think this person's caused trouble, we're going to monitor them or something. This is somebody who's entirely innocent, who bewildered by what had happened. Newcastle United and I understand the Premier League have doubled down on this, and in response to this being reported as a Stasi-like act of censorship, which is what it is, it's very reminiscent of what used to happen in East Germany. They've doubled down and basically said her Facebook posts contravene Newcastle United's diversity policy, and therefore they're not going to back down. There is a campaign. There's a lot of people have commented on it, often the usual suspects, but it has gone wider than that. But I just hope that in the way that every time there's an instance of racism, it is highlighted, often, quite rightly, and then some action is taken, it would be good if this is taken in the same way in wider society, and something will happen. I do think what Lindsay has done and her campaign does go against the grain, and I think it will take the Premier League A lot of people think, oh, it's a football thing or whatever, which it is, but it's more than that. The Premier League are very powerful. They're very big, or they say they're very big on diversity, and they will be reluctant to back down on this, as will Newcastle United. The irony being that when Newcastle United was taken over by Saudi owners a couple of years ago, people were worried that what would happen would be that the Saudi owners would bring in some kind of Middle Eastern style censorship into Newcastle, or by association of their actions in Saudi Arabia, or alleged actions in Saudi Arabia, that would somehow tarnish Newcastle United. It was damning on the Newcastle United fans that they went along with this, whereas in fact it's good old British censorship on gender critical issues, which has been the issue and is the issue that we should all be concerned about. And hopefully after a campaign, something will happen. But I do think this will be quite a big fight.
You know, I did wonder, just because it's Newcastle United, whether they were bending the stick the other way just to kind of prove how right on and woke they are. And it is Newcastle United that has suspended her rather than the Premier League. But those two elements, the fact that the Premier League are monitoring people's social media, and secondly, that even speech that doesn't occur within the ground or have anything to do with the club can be used by the club to censor supporters is kind of really, really worrying on two fronts. And there's also, I mean, it's kind of related in a way, is the case in Germany of Bayer Leverkusen being fined €18,000 because somebody put a sign up in the ground, it's trolling the Werder Bremen fans, who apparently are regarded as rather lefty and progressive, that, you know, there are many different types of music but only two genders. So the German Football Association decided to fine Bayer Leverkusen for this disgraceful act. And then straight afterwards, at Dynamo Dresden fans put up a sign saying, there's one ridiculous German Football Association and there's still only two genders. Which is funny. That's what football trolling is. But it also indicates that the fans themselves have a certain degree of common sense much greater than the leaders of football, either in Germany or in England.
Just really quickly, I think the revelation that the person who is likely to have designed this policy had previously been a senior Whitehall Mandarin who specialised in EDI, equity, diversity and inclusion for the government, then moves over into the private sector of football and the Premier League, and then is in charge of, or one of the people who design their governance and their how they deal with fans. Anyway, that tells you a story. Secondly, a terrible announcement this week, in my opinion, is that Kick It Out, which is the rather self-regarding, policing of all things anti-racism in football, allegedly, have decided that there is such a problem with Islamophobia on the terraces that they need a new czar of fighting Islamophobia. And it's Baroness Varzi, who sits in the House of Lords with me, who, as we know, is somebody that is, to say the least, obsessed with the idea that there's Islamophobia everywhere. So I think we can see politics and football fans and people being demonised for having the wrong bigotry, according to very senior people, is likely to be one of those issues that runs and runs. So I really do hope that there's a fans, kick back against Kick It Out and all of these impositions.
Okay, moving to a slightly different issue, there is a bit of a smell wafting across Europe, and that smell is coming from cities and streets filled up with manure and bales of hay, and protests, quite serious and very large protests from farmers calling attention to some very serious issues in agriculture, policies penalising the use of fertilisers, making it extremely expensive, endless amounts of red tape around what farmers can do and how they can grow crops and what kind of rules there are around animal husbandry. People coming out and saying that it is becoming impossible to be in the world of farming, to do anything without becoming bankrupt. And there has been quite an exciting pushback. Holland, France, Germany, Belgium, Poland, Romania, Ireland. It's becoming a real movement. So, Jacob, You've been doing a lot of work in Brussels. You've been following this quite closely. Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, well, I mean, some of the things will be familiar to anyone in the UK who's watched a single episode of Clarkson's Farm. But there are lots of different things going on. There's obviously this is happening right across Europe from east to west. And of course, there's going to be some local differences in some of the issues that are most salient there. But the thing that unites right across the continent is the fact that the rubber is beginning to hit the road as part of the EU's environmental agenda, and farmers have kind of been forced into the crosshairs so that the EU can meet its targets on net zero. And this plays out in a variety of ways. You've mentioned fertilizers. They've been going after nitrates emissions for quite a long time. They've been increasing the amount of land that farmers have to set aside as part of this. And an emerging dynamic is also coming out where the EU has identified that they can kind of, if they can stop farmers farming on farmland, then they can use that farmland now as a kind of like rewilded area that can then be traded to someone else as a carbon credit. So you can essentially have like a chemicals factory can in effect buy the carbon that was going to have been emitted by a farm by them kind of putting the farm and letting the land lie fallow. So there's a whole range of issues. But what's happening is that farmers right across Europe are beginning to, or have been picking up on this for some time, and they've kind of reached the end of their tether because lots of these policies are literally making farming, and especially and most importantly for small farmers, they're making farming untenable. They're making it unprofitable. And also farmers are incredibly fed up with the fact that they have been doing their utmost to try and make sensible reductions in emissions, keep on top of the latest bureaucracy and paperwork, which is really, really onerous. Again, people remember Clarkson's Farm, and it's probably even worse in the EU. And each time they've kind of gone out of their way to reduce emissions or to make their farms more compliant, the response of elites in Europe has just been, once again, to throw in new laws. And farmers really are fed up of this. And so they're out on the streets, they're protesting, they've been causing a huge amount of disruption. So much so that in Holland, there are laws being discussed to criminalize, to ban these protests. Emergency laws look like they're being brought forward. But the kind of as inspiring as this kind of populist outburst of anti-environmental protesting is as depressing as the response of European elites. And so they've been very quick to label anybody involved in these protests as far right, probably funded by Russia, or kind of the return of fascism. And they've got people all across the radios and on all of the podcasts discussing this. The first question they ask any farmer they meet is, so how many far right agitators have you been exposed to? And how many people have you had to keep out your mind? And so it just shows the complete cluelessness of elites on this issue, that they can't recognize that it's the direct response of policies that they've been pushing with little regard for the consequences, and instead seek to blame and demonize those who stand up against them.
One of the interesting things is that we have just had, because of obviously the war in Ukraine, which might seem like a million years ago, but it wasn't when it started. There was, you know, an international discussion about food security, and you had all these nations under quite serious stress, thinking about and realizing that they had taken for granted the idea of food security and needed to look at it quite seriously. And obviously central to food security are the people who do the work of growing the food or raising the livestock in order to put food into the supermarkets. So there's a sort of they've completely forgotten that, it seems like, forgotten the importance of farmers. And there is a bit like the discussion of the Gilets Jaunes, just a very sort of snobby, dismissive, as you've outlined it, Jacob, disregard for these sort of dirty country people who are probably backward and don't know anything other than, you know, what the weather's going to be like today. And there's a really nasty elitism to all of this, which is coming to the fore. Claire, what have you thought about this?
Well, I just wanted to note that, being from Irish farming stock, that my relatives who were farmers, who, you know, are marginally interested, madly interested in current affairs, were absolutely incensed the last time I saw them, and lecturing and going on and on about the madness created by environmental policies on the issue of farmers. And I thought that, you know, on how to cope as farmers, they weren't particularly political about it. They weren't They didn't have an ideological commitment to being opposed to environmentalism. They were just furious that nobody thought of the consequences. And there was two things that I thought, and I've subsequently thought seeing interviews, is that to then, in countries that are so recently rural countries like Ireland or France, for the people in the establishment to call them far right is just, you know, that's like absolutely insulting to so many people. Because if you're not a farmer, you're related to one in Ireland. Do you know what I mean? There's no, what do you mean? There is no such thing as the urban elite, right? Everybody's a farmer somewhere down the line, only one, two generations ago. So it just doesn't wash well. It's going to backfire. And secondly, there was more and more anti-EU sentiment associated with this. I don't know how deep that goes, but a lot of the my farming family were outraged that I voted Brexit, with one or two exceptions. But in fact, they were much more saying, oh, maybe we get your point, because, you know, Brussels have been useless. In fact, they're the problem, and we're ranting about Brussels. So, you know, these small seeds of disaffection about the European Union, I think, are also an important part of this story.
Yeah, I live in hope of an IREXit, because it would encapsulate something of the irateness of going with the EU. I know I can see some bad puns there. But Rob, there's another dynamic to all of this, which is that alongside, as Jacob says, the sort of depressing response from European elites to these kind of populist outbursts on the streets, and the sort of almost a practiced response by now, there is shakiness within this sort of green environmentalist agenda, because of the realities of what a lot of European countries are going through at the moment. Well, a lot of countries everywhere, in terms of cost of living crisis and economic downturn, which is that these sort of pie in the sky green ideals don't add up, quite literally. And the news last night emerged that the Labour Party, in its most recent U-turn, has announced that it will not be following its $28 billion green investment pledge. This is a pledge that has already been sort of brought down a little bit from its initial pronouncements. And every Labour Party politician that's been on the airwaves this morning and last night has sort of tried to characterise this as, we're just being very sensible, we want our manifesto to be watertight, we don't want to promise anything that we can't live up to, blah, blah, blah. But in essence, it's a realization from the Labour Party that it cannot make the idea of green investment, environmentalism, net zero work financially. So anything you think on that, what's going on there, and anything you want to say about the farmers as well, Rob?
Well, just on Labour, as you say, that's been coming for quite some time. So a couple of years ago, this was their big flagship promise that they were going to be serious about environmentalism, but and have this green investment. But it was also their flagship promise on economic growth. They were claiming that this would be green growth. They were copying a lot of these ideas from the Biden administration in America. But the Tories have had a field day with it, as much as the Tories have had a field day with anything, about committing to spending £28 billion every year from the start of a Labour government on these initiatives. And so the first of all, they said, oh, we won't be able to do £28 billion in the first year, and we'll build up to it. And now they're basically scrapping that idea altogether. So that's all about taking some ammunition away from the Tories about the economy and about fiscal responsibility. But obviously that does leave a hole in the policies, both about the environment and about where is this economic growth going to come from if it's not from this kind of initiative. So there's that. But that doesn't mean that they've given up on all the other stuff. So, for example, they are promising to decarbonize the electricity production in the UK by 2030. This is mad. This is completely impossible. Not only because they still haven't got any way of solving the problem of the intermittency of wind and solar power, but we're in a situation where we're going to be closing more nuclear power stations before we opened one, and we're now looking at the 2030s before Hinkley Point C is up and running. And they just don't have any answers to this. And even people, trade unions or whatever in their own side, are saying this isn't not possible, alongside the idea that they're going to ban the dishing out of licenses for oil and gas in the North Sea. Again, the unions are saying this just make no sense whatsoever in terms of energy security. So they've kind of hit the brick wall of reality on this 28 billion pound pledge, but they haven't yet got to that point when it comes to some of their other initiatives. And that is the real worry, is that we are going to end up paying a lot of money and being impoverished as Labour try and fail to try to deliver these policies.
Labour think, or they're ahead in the polls. The Conservatives are obviously unpopular. There's a few, in fact, there's three by-elections this month, all of which the Conservatives look like they'll do very badly in. Labour will do a bit better. But overall, when you come into an election and you remove all your policies, which are at all distinctive, that make you look different from the governing party, however unpopular they are, things are very volatile. You don't know what's going to happen. You only have to look back to 2019 when the Conservatives got, I think it was 9% in the European elections. And then at the end of the year, they won the general election. And whilst we're not in 2019, when you have a situation of two parties who are almost indistinguishable and fighting over not very substantial issues, which they're doing at Prime Minister's question times, it makes it quite arbitrary, I think you would say, what may happen when an election comes. And I think that's a real danger for Labour now. That doesn't mean that the Conservatives are in a good position, but I do think it makes things quite unpredictable.
The only thing that I'd add is, in line with what Rob said about Labour's still, remaining commitment to the ideology around environmentalism and net zero and all the rest of it is extremely depressing. As much as, the 28 billion green investment pledge was, whatever, you can pick holes in it and criticize it. I mean, the fact that the Labour Party is gutting all of its pledges for investment, and keeping all of the policies that are about limiting choices and cracking down on quality of life and doing things that will, arguably damage the economy and people's private sort of finances in terms of raising costs for energy and all the rest of it, making driving more difficult. It's just as bit of it's just a kind of a sign of the times that all the sort of at least relatively or maybe even just symbolic sort of commitment to the idea of growth and moving forward with the economy is cut, and everything that's left is the sort of depressing stuff. And it's, Labour's argument is, well, the Conservatives have screwed up the economy, and so sort of hands in the air, there's nothing we can do. We're beholden to this, terrible situation we're in. If you listen to Rachel Reeves, all she ever says is, well, we have to wait and see what kind of awful situation we're in come the next election, and then we will make the sort of belt tightening decisions we have to make. It is, we live in a current time where the only alternative is, well, there is no alternative. The only order of the day is austerity, whether it's green austerity or something else. And that's a very depressing situation for politics to be in. And we wait to see whether this election comes in May or October or November, but there has it's quite marked how little excitement there is, how little sort of sense of people wanting to get out to the polls there is. I think turnout is going to be very low unless something interesting happens on the sideline. I think, as always, we have to look outside of parliamentary politics, whether it's to the farmers, whether it's to campaigns like Lindsay Smith's, or people doing things outside of the sort of House of Commons, palaces of Westminster, to where the real politics is. So anyway, stay tuned for more podcasts of ideas. Really excitingly, this week and in this Substack, we've announced the new dates for the Battle of Ideas Festival this year, which is the 19th and 20th of October. So make sure you get your tickets. We've got all kinds of concessions, special deals. If you subscribe to this Substack and become an AOI associate, there's lots of extra material you can get and various deals. We've got so many events on the roster between now and October. So stay tuned, get involved, subscribed, and we'll see you again soon.